Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Western audiences have been flooded with one wave after another of propaganda when it comes to Ukraine. But what matters most is the generation of political and strategic facts. For example, the induction of four Ukrainian regions into Russia and the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines. These realities will determine the outcome of this conflict. Crosstalking the moment of truth, I'm joined by my guest, Vladimir Goldstein in Providence. He is the chair of the Department of Slavic Studies at Brown University. In Washington, we have Michael Maloof. He is a former Pentagon senior security policy analyst. And in Tanzania, we have Ted See. He is a conflict consultant and a retired U.S. Foreign Service officer. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, let me go to you first here. Political facts are what matter most. Joseph Borrell said this conflict in Ukraine will be won on the battlefield. The only thing he's ever said that I agree with. So if we have the induction of these four regions of Ukraine into Russia after referenda, and then we have this very strange but basically very expected sabotage of the Nord Stream. Both are turning points and for me, because once these provinces, regions are part of Russia, they will never be negotiated away. There's no negotiation that Russia will be involved in. And with the sabotage of these pipelines, it will probably never be built. I wouldn't do it. They'll just be blown up again. The quote-unquote leverage Moscow had with Europe is gone. So we're in a very different trajectory now, and I'm very emphatic. When everything is said and done, one side wins and one side loses. There's no win-win here. Michael in Washington.
No, not at this point. It appears that all options have been broken now to try to reach a settlement on this thing. The hope was that there would be some form of settlement, but this blowing up of the pipeline seems to have been the proverbial straw. I think Moscow has basically decided just to look eastward and go its Eurasian path. And it's going to be very, very difficult for Europeans. And it really is a reflection on a win for the U.S. ultimately and its oil companies. It basically now has made Europe a slave to U.S. Energy once again, because they're going to be needing that very, very shortly. And already the U.S. is at capacity and delivery. And the Europeans are going to be having a very, very difficult time trying to find any substitutes in the near term. I understand that Chancellor Scholz of Germany was just in Saudi Arabia, didn't get what he wanted.
He got one. One ship.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. But
he ultimately.
But Michael, I'll also we have to point out that the energy that Europe will be importing from the U.S. will be very, very expensive, okay?
Yes.
That is the game changer.
Yes.
Vladimir, let me go to you, because this has been just as much a war on Germany as it has been on Russia. It's really quite amazing, the parallels here, because Germany's economy is going to have a very difficult time recovering. Remarkably, who would have thought some German companies want to move to America because they have cheaper prices, okay? This is all part of the plan here. But let's stay with Ukraine here. If there's going to be any kind of negotiated end, and the conflicts do have a negotiated end, I have to wonder if Kiev is even going to be at the table. Vladimir, your thoughts.
Yeah, I think first thing we have to remember that NATO sticks to its kind of old slogans to keep Russia out and Germany down and Americans in. And this blowing up the pipe is just precisely like one master stroke, I would say, which accomplishes this goal. What it also accomplishes, it sends a very, very kind of powerful and strong message all over the world, Russia and China in particular. I imagine the Chinese are watching it with tremendous attention. I already saw some tweets from Chinese officials. They don't buy, of course, this narrative that Russia is involved. They know who did it, and they know that they can be next, because this is, they're watching, of all people, they're watching what United States can do what the NATO can do with great attention. So in the long run, it might be sort of a good move against, you know, Germany and Russia. But, you know, Chinese will definitely will consider it, you know, and take it into consideration in their, for the policies. And the last point is, of course, is Russia. You know, I know in Russian culture and history, from the Peter the Great, Russians always take West seriously, try to be partners, try to learn, view them as older brothers, view them as teachers. But the more West does, you know, stance like that, the more Russians turn either, you know, eastward or inward. And I think it finally we did reach this point that Russia says, you know, who cares what you guys do? You know, we cannot rely on you. You cannot teach us anything except propaganda, except sort of, you know, conducting fake sham referendums, elections, regime changes all over the world. We can do that too. So I think I'm not sure that the West, basically, you know, NATO sending the right message all over the world. They're teaching people in cynicism, watching out rather than cooperating. And this is very disturbing. So they might succeed in the short term of keeping Germany down and benefiting oil companies. But in the long term, it looks very, very bad.
Well, Ted, the pipeline story is very interesting. First of all, we'll probably never know how it happened, because no one is particularly interested other than the Russians in trying to find out what happened. But I'd like to point out Washington over the last news cycle has been very quiet about whose fault it is. That's really unusual, considering everything is Russia's fault these days. But Ted, then there are those in Europe, like the Poles, like the Baltics, they don't want to have any relationship with Russia. Well, that's basically coming true right now. There won't be one, but there's a caveat to that. Then why, if Russia's not going to have a relationship with the West, then Russia's going to set its own security terms, hence the induction of these provinces of Ukraine into Russia. Further, others could join it. Odessa comes to mind here. So they don't really have to care what the West cares, what they think about it. They do have to worry about how they'll react militarily. But, I mean, Russia can do what it needs to do unilaterally based on its own needs. Kiev is not a reliable interlocutor, and obviously NATO is hostile. Go ahead, Ted.
Peter, this is all the inevitable consequence of not dissolving NATO back in 1990 after its reason for existence vanished. And we've seen over the years that there have been attempts to negotiate a better balance between Europe and its American sort of big brother and weapons provider on the one hand and Russia on the other. And that's steadily gone downhill since at least the time that Vladimir Putin took over as president the first time around. And what we've seen recently is just an astonishing series of actions. And I wouldn't mind taking a second to detail them. You've got the provision of advanced anti-ship missiles and guidance therefrom and, you know, training therefore from NATO to the Ukrainians to use against Russian vessels, anti-radiation missiles that haven't been shared outside of NATO, as far as I can tell. You've got sharing of intelligence for the use in the assassination in the field of Russian general officers. You've got the use of a very high-tech guided missile, which is accurate supposedly to within 1 meter after flying for 300 kilometers, to assassinate a Ukrainian politician in a hotel. And there happened, by the way, to be an RT film crew right next door who survived the attack, but only just. And finally, you've got the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines. Let's turn this around and imagine that any one of these things happened to the U.S. Do you think there'd be hesitation in declaring war?
Yeah, well, you bring up the most important point. Let me go to Michael to kind of flesh this out here, because I think, you know, we all know that on Friday, Vladimir Putin will make a public address. It's highly anticipated considering the events that have been happening. I tend to think, my crystal ball, reading my tea leaves here, he may decide to declare that the U.S. and NATO were belligerents in the conflict in Ukraine. And that has huge, huge implications. Michael.
Well, I absolutely agree. We're in uncharted waters right now. This is an event that we're seeing, a series of events that we're seeing that are almost out of control. There's no leadership. Everyone is reacting at this point, and it's going to create havoc, and it's going to get worse. And I see the Russians intensifying, I would not doubt that Mr. Putin will not only declare NATO and U.S. as belligerents, but also try to maybe even consider severing diplomatic relations, because the blowing up of that pipeline, in effect, was an act of war. So I think the
Michael, if I can add to that, it is a declaration of war the way I look at it. But Michael, importantly, yes. Also, civilian infrastructure is no longer, you know, it's not no longer verboten. They've sent that message. Okay, Vladimir, you were nodding your head in agreement. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it opens a Pandora box, if you wish. And I think I want to return to this point, which you said that Washington is kind of very reticent about, you know, blaming Russia. But also simultaneously, what I hear that right away, Norwegian companies, Norwegian government, Norwegian representatives say, we are watching for our pipeline and we are preparing all the forces of NATO to defend it. So why are they saying it? That, you know, it means like they're afraid, like to answer back, that they did something and now they say, watch out, we're going to defend our pipeline. So this is a very uncharted territories. And I think it's a short-termism, ultimately. I have a feeling that, you know, this referenda and, you know, joining of the companies was like a very decisive chess move. So I think NATO decided to have their move. But I think how it's going to play out eventually between Russia and NATO, between Germany, in all countries, it's unknown. And I think I'm not sure from what we've seen so far from Western leadership that they actually, you know, considered all the options, all the variants. You know, I don't think that, you know, they have stupid people, but they might have people like short-term people who sometimes base their decisions on the rather kind of faulty information, which they get from Kyiv government, yeah, which always exaggerates. So they might base it on a faulty premise.
Well, Vladimir, faulty narratives create faulty policy outcomes. We're seeing this right in real time here. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the events in Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing events in Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Ted and Tanzania. I want to flesh out something you said earlier about the intelligence assistance to Ukraine by NATO countries. I think that, you know, with the pipeline incident, the sabotage there, in your mind, as a former foreign service officer, would you be surprised, for example, that suddenly NATO satellites started dropping out of the sky? This is very, very an important element of Ukraine's defense posture right now, offensive posture. Considering most analysts, military people have told me that the Ukrainian army was destroyed during the summer. So in every single way, Russia is fighting NATO. So why should those satellites stay in the sky? Ted.
Well, my only answer would be sort of a prayerful hope that we could prevent World War III here. But unfortunately, tit for tat is an entirely legitimate tactic in a situation like this. You know, with civilian infrastructure, as you say, destroyed, for that matter, the civilian hotel that was targeted by, you know, a guided missile, for God's sake, for an assassination of one person, talk about overkill. Someone's got to be rational here. Someone's got to be reasonable, but we can't keep expecting Russia to be that someone all the time without some kind of reciprocation. And as you noted earlier, it's as though there's been a deliberate burning of the bridges so that there's no going back. And no one wants, in Washington, it seems, in NATO capitals, no one wants the possibility of real negotiations for some kind of least bad alternative lasting peace.
Yeah, well, that's because they've created this rhetorical environment where you can't take a word back. You can't, because if you're reasonable, that's appeasement. That's Munich, okay? They're in a trap. They're in a linguistic mind trap. They can't get out of it. Michael, we have to talk about these republics joining Russia because they will become Russian soil, sovereign. And the Russians have made it very clear. This isn't a bluff. Now, this is the next stage, and we're in the most dangerous stage of all, because Russia will defend these new Russian republics. Go ahead, Michael.
No, absolutely. I fully anticipate that happening, and that's one of the reasons why there was an effort to bring them immediately into the Russian Federation, and it's basically a red line for Ukraine. If you start shelling them again, we're going to attack, and I anticipate that Russian attacks will occur in a much more definite way, and particularly as winter approaches. And I also see greater cyber attacks to get at the point that you were talking about earlier, not only against the Ukrainians and their ability to communicate, but also against the West generally. I think there may be actually a severing of communications in some respects between Russia and, let's say, Washington itself. Breaking up potential diplomatic relations. This thing could escalate very, very rapidly, and it will easily get out of control. But the whole notion of Ukraine attacking the provinces now are going to be very, very dire if they go ahead and do something like that. And I then see attacks on the leadership positions and the command and control areas. Unlike what we've seen before.
Well, exactly. And Vladimir, you know, from where I am here in Moscow, I have to admit a level of frustration. It looks like the Russian military is fighting with one arm tied behind its back. I mean, Kiev is in one piece. Their command and control is in one piece. They have a Ho Chi Minh Trail in Poland. I mean, you know, at what point does Russia just say, enough is enough? We know we're all the entry points. Points are. We know we can see everything going on. And hey, look, we'll give you 30 minutes to clear your guys because the missiles are coming in and they're going to destroy everything coming across the border because they can see it. Go ahead, Vladimir.
Yeah, I think this referenda and this joining of this four districts are very, very important. And they're important primarily, you know, for domestic Russian audience. Because, you know, let's not forget, Russians are unbelievably patriotic. And they went to all this, you know, patriotic wars against Napoleon and Hitler and this and that. So now, you know, it's not like, you know, we have to fight, you know, NATO somewhere in Ukraine, and then there is all those arguments, NATO defends helpless Ukraine. Now what Russian public will see is this NATO and Ukraine and others are actually attacking and invading and bombing and destroying Russian territory. So that will definitely sort of have a very big impact there. And I think we're talking about, you know, waking up a bear. And I think Russians, for their country, for defense of their land, they do anything. You know, they do much more than the Westerners or Americans or anyone, because Americans are not invaded. Americans are coming to Russia to invade, and Russians will fight back with all they have. So I think it's a very, very dangerous game. And I think public, again, when there is, like, you know, something happening on Ukrainian territory, maybe a Russian public is very reluctant sending bombers to, you know, Lviv or Kiev or something. But if, you know, the Russian territory is attacked again and again and again, then there'll be a giant outcry, let's hit them back. And then I don't know, you know, who benefits from that.
You know, Ted, you know, the memory of the Second World War in the West is dimmed. There's a lot of revisionism going on. But what happened in June 1941 is seared into the memory, the consciousness of every Russian. And they have vowed never to let that happen again. That's why I'm agreeing with what Vladimir had to say. This is visceral for them. Victory Day is the most sacred day in the calendar. The West doesn't seem to get that. Ted.
We don't study history anymore, Peter. We've given it up for watching the Kardashians, quite frankly. There is no communal memory because that generation's passed away. We think we understand what happened because we've seen documentaries on PBS or CBS or, you know, whatever entertainment channel happens to be pretending to be a history channel. But it's not the same thing. There's not the blood and soil mixed together the way there was in different Soviet territories, certainly in Russia. So you're absolutely right. There's a huge imbalance of memory here and of grievance having to do with invasion. And I don't see a way forward militarily for the West other than continuing to pump obscenely expensive materials into Ukrainian hands, and they're going through them faster than the West can provide them, as far as I can tell. So at some point, there's going to be a crisis of supply, of charity, if you will. I think that, purses are going to start being zipped closed, especially, as you mentioned before, once the cold winter sets in. So I don't see a good way forward here is in terms of continuing a conflict. But now that the bridges have been burnt, nor do I see a way back towards diplomacy.
I have to completely agree with you. Michael, I've over the last couple of weeks, I've had this habit of asking this question because I like it, because it brings out different responses. So it's your turn to answer this one. Who's got the clocks and who's got the time in this conflict? Go ahead.
At this point, I think Russia does.
Both are one or the other?
The clock and what was the other one?
Clock and time. Who's got the clock? Who's got the time?
I think Russia has both. It can hold out for as long as it can. The United States is up against a very serious election coming up. The people don't like this war, and they have other things on their mind. And the Europeans are getting fed up, and they're seeing that this is getting them nowhere. You got protests going on in Germany now, and all that Russia has to do is wait it out. And it's going to be I think the Europeans are going to ultimately recoil from all of this and finally say enough. In spite of the fact that Victoria Nuland and company are back there pushing, but at some point they're going to see that this is not benefiting them. They're going to have a very harsh winter, and the Russians have been through it all before. They can do it again. I think that hardship that you talk about is probably genetic. In the Russian psyche as well.
It's one of the things you learn living among Russians, that there is a high level of stoicism. They're very stoic when you're up against the wall. They're very stoic and they work in unison. Other than that, they never do. But when they're threatened, they come together, and it's something to watch. Vladimir, the idea that. The idea of having regime change in Russia, which is ridiculous here. But I do foresee a regime change in Berlin. I think Sergeant Schultz will be sent packing and his coalition very soon. Yeah, I did say that. Sergeant Schultz. Go ahead, Vladimir.
That's absolutely the case. I think, Russians under pressure get together. So even if there will be like a, the people talk about regime change, it'll be like absolutely tougher guy if there is some change in Russia, which would be the no-nonsense guy. But, in terms of Germany and England, they don't have time. We see like protests already after like 1 month in the office already, Liz Truss is doing kind of total, bungle of economy. Germany is not going to do well. Well, what I want to stress is that, yes, those who know history, those who know Russians know that they can persevere. But I think Western calculations are always based on some, as we said, faulty logic. They get some strange statistics which tells them that Russian economy is weak. Russians don't have this. Russians don't have that. Ukrainians send this information again to Washington saying, yes, we are winning. Russians are collapsing. They're running out of ammunition. They're running out of this equipment. So this idea that Russians are running out is just very, very naive, very faulty. But I think, so in other words, Russia does have time and clock on their hand, but the West actually thinks that we do. And that's very dangerous. That's very, very dangerous. If you come to the fight with a gun unloaded and think it's loaded as opposed to your opponent, what will happen? But I think, time will tell, of course.
I'm predicting that Liz Truss will be looking for political asylum in Kyiv before the end of the winter. That's my prediction. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Providence, Washington, and in Tasmania. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.